So we're midway through this sixth chapter, the synthesis of the disciplines of knowledge. We should remember before we commence that Sri Aurobindo did closely read some Vedantic literature from the school of Shankara closely in Sanskrit. He also had an abiding love and respect for Sri Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekananda, his Shakti. Sri Ramakrishna was not a student of literature. He was a spiritual genius, relying on his own conscious adventure into spiritual realms. He came to know the divine as an absolute, in the pure Vedantic sense of the term. He came to know the divine as the beloved, as the all-loving mother who destroys in order to create, as an immanent reality, all the universe held within the conscious being of this one who takes any name and every name. What is your favorite? It is that too. And Swami Vivekananda, when writing about the nature of knowledge, begins his book, Raja Yoga, in its introductory section by saying, all our knowledge is based upon experience. This is absolutely concordant with what Sri Ramakrishna felt. Sri Aurobindo, of course, has made this fundamental to his reading of the world in the Life Divine, his magnum opus. Swami Vivekananda goes on to say, a couple of paragraphs after writing that, thus it is clear that all the religions of the world have been built upon that one universal and adamantine foundation of all our knowledge, direct experience. It is that directness, no intercession, no space between, the knower becoming one with the known, that is knowledge. Keeping this in our mind, let's go forward now. We pick it up here. The self is an eternal, utter being and pure existence of which all these things are becomings. The self, the Atman, is that. Tat is being, Sat. It really is. But all of these things which seem to become in time and space, which move, which come and go, all these things are expressions of that single existence. It is timeless. These things enter into all stadia of being through all measurements of time. From this knowledge, we have to proceed. This knowledge we have to realize and make it the foundation of the inner and the outer life of the individual. The yoga of knowledge, starting from this primary truth, has conceived a negative and positive method of discipline by which we shall get rid of these false identifications and recoil back from them into true self-knowledge. The negative method is to say always, I am not the body, so as to contradict and root out the false idea, I am the body, to concentrate on this knowledge, and by renunciation of the attachment of the soul to the physical, get rid of the body sense. We say again, I am not the life. And by concentration on this knowledge and renunciation of attachment to the vital movements and desires, get rid of the life sense. We say, finally, I am not the mind, the motion, the sense, the thought. And by concentration on this knowledge and renunciation of the mental activities, get rid of the mind sense. When we thus constantly create a gulf between ourselves and the things with which we identified ourselves, their veils progressively fall away from us, and the self begins to be visible to our experience. So this is all a process by which we disidentify our conscious being with every layer of Prakriti's happenings. We look at the body, I am not that. And in fact, when we sit for meditation, is this not what we do? We first sit, we become comfortable, then we forget about the body. We notice the movements of our emotions, but the steadiness of our breath brings them calm, and we forget about all of our feelings and the impacts that they have upon us. We rise to the level of our thoughts, and by pacification, we withdraw our attention from them, leave them where they stood, no longer regard them as part of our being. So whether it's body, the life energies, or the mental flow, we identify with none of that. We become a detached consciousness, a sheer consciousness, witnessing or not witnessing that which plays before us in all of these worlds, because each strand of being is a world in itself, a world in interplay with all the other worlds. We've created a gulf. The person, the Purusha, views the nature, the Prakriti. But there is a distance, and that distance they would define as freedom, as liberation. Of that, then, we say, I am that, the pure, the eternal, the self-blissful. And by concentrating our thought and being upon it, we become that and are able finally to renounce the individual existence and the cosmos. Another positive method, belonging rather to the Raja Yoga, is to concentrate on the thought of the Brahman and shut out from us all other ideas, so that this dynamo of mind shall cease to work upon our external or varied internal existence. By mental cessation, the vital and physical play also shall fall to rest in an eternal samadhi, some inexpressible deepest trance of the being in which we shall pass into the absolute existence. So Raja Yoga, the royal way, the royal method of yoga, drawn primarily from what we now call the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, recorded 2nd, 3rd century CE, but certainly existing far before then, already on record in an earlier form in the Mahabharata, apart from the Gita. Concentration, dharana, of the thought of the Brahman, whether it is a visualized image, an ishta devata, a mantra, or this concept, one plunges the consciousness into that. So only that exists. And it is by exclusivity, by the focus, by the sheer force of your tapasya, that you are able to enter into conscious communion with that which you seek. All this falls away. There is a union of the seeker and the sought, a plunging into that which is beyond expression. Who can tell what is that identity? Who can say what is that power of forceful communion? This discipline is evidently a self-centered and exclusive inner movement which gets rid of the world by denying it in thought and shutting the eyes of the soul to it in vision. So by plunging yourself into that absolute, you have lost yourself to the world. But the universe is there as a truth in God, even though the individual soul may have shut its eyes to it, and the self is there in the universe really, and not falsely, supporting all that we have rejected, truly immanent in all things, really embracing the individual in the universal, as well as embracing the universe in that which exceeds and transcends it. So here we are. This is a deeper experience. Sri Aurobindo will suggest from time to time in his letters, correspondence about yoga, and he says also in the Synthesis of Yoga, there can be a point in your personal progress where your sadhana demands that you disinvest yourself from identification with all this nature, but it must be temporary. It must not be absolute. This cleavage between soul and nature is itself a limitation. The Ishu Upanishad talks about this in a very convincing way, a way that laughs at the seeker of knowledge for falling into a greater darkness. What shall we do with this eternal self in this persistent universe which we see encompassing us every time we come out of the trance of inner meditation? What shall we do? The ascetic path of knowledge has its solution and its discipline for the soul that looks out on the universe. It is to regard the immanent and all-encompassing and all-constituting self in the image of the ether in which all forms are, which is in all forms, of which all forms are made. In that ether, cosmic life and mind move as the breath of things, an atmospheric sea in the ethereal, and constitute from it all these forms. But what they constitute are merely name and form and not realities. The form of the pot we see is a form of earth only and goes back into the earth. Earth, a form, resolvable into the cosmic life, the cosmic life, a movement that falls to rest in that silent, immutable ether. Concentrating on this knowledge, rejecting all phenomenon and appearance, we come to see the whole as an illusion of name and form in the ether that is Brahman. It becomes unreal to us, and the universe becoming unreal, the immanence becomes unreal, and there is only the self upon which our mind has falsely imposed the name and form of the universe. Thus are we justified in the withdrawal of the individual self into the absolute. This is the position, certainly, of Shankara and of those who follow him. It is not the position of everybody who wrote a line of Vedantic philosophy, but it is that world-renouncing theory that Sri Aurobindo has most to contend with here, because he aims at a synthesis of knowledge and inclusion of all possible forms of spiritual knowing, not excluding all, but the one experience of the ineffable, but all the principles of existence. If there is a tat, a that, there is also the tattvas who arise from that, the principles of pure existence, the thatness of things, which is inescapable and discoverable in our experience. This Sri Aurobindo would lead us to, and not a withdrawal of the individual soul back into that oceanic absolute. Still, the self goes on with its imperishable aspect of immanence, its immutable aspect of divine envelopment, its endless trick of becoming each thing and all things. Our detection of the cheat and our withdrawal do not seem to affect one tittle, either the self or the universe. You have to love his sense of humor. This is wonderful. So we plunge consciously into that oceanic absolute and we disappear. But the self goes on. It is imperishable, even when it hides in all things that move. The immanence, the universality of things, all this world is just dripping with the divine presence. Its immutable aspect of divine envelopment, if you can imagine the divine with this colossal embrace, hugs the worlds, all the worlds, and says, "You are mine, I am yours." Envelops all of it. Its endless trick of becoming, because if Maya is anything, she is a power to measure the infinite down into the finite and hide the infinite inside each finite form. So if we detect what she's doing, aha, she doesn't mind. Well, good, now you're in on the secret. Must we not then know also what it is that thus persists, superior to our acceptance and rejection, and too great, too eternal to be affected by it? Here too, there must be some invincible reality at work, and the integrality of knowledge demands that we shall see and realize it. Otherwise, it may prove that our own knowledge, and not the Lord in the universe, was the cheat and the illusion. I know, integrate from integer one. So that which is integral is all together. Therefore, we must concentrate again dharana. We must concentrate again and see and realize also this, which persists so sovereignly, and must know the self as no other than the Supreme Soul, Parapurusha, which is the Lord of Nature, Isha, the upholder of cosmic existence, by whose sanction it proceeds, whose will compels its multitudinous actions and determines its perpetual cycles. We are back again to the opening verse of the Isha Upanishad. And you could say this Lord of existence, which is described in the Gita, in the 4th chapter, the 6th verse. And we must yet concentrate once again and see and realize and must know the self as the one existence who is both the soul of all and the nature of all, at once Purusha and Prakriti, and so able both to express himself in all these forms of things, and to be all these formations. Otherwise, we have excluded what the self does not exclude, and made a willful choice in our knowledge. So we can cheat, we can exclude, but the divine does not. We've looked so many times at the image of Nataraja, which is one of the most moving symbols from Indian art to ever impress itself upon the mind of humanity. And we see there the form of that one who sits high in the Himalayan, white in sheer auspicious being, who nevertheless dances creatively and furiously and with full rapture, that which becomes all this universe, which is always contained within his conscious being, because there's this rim of fire all around him in his cosmic dance. And as he creates all the worlds, and he guides the seeker, the evolving spirit, from plane to plane, from station to station, through whatever means he must, until finally he beckons. And he says, don't fear, come to me. And as you come to that divine being, you see, you look at that face, and while all this furious dance is going on, there is the supreme peace. His eyes are turned in. He has never left his transcendence in becoming this universality, in becoming you. He stands at the center of your being, and you move within the orbit of his being. Where else could you ever be? The old ascetic path of knowledge admitted the unity of things and the concentration on all these aspects of the one existence, but it made a distinction and a hierarchy. So we're talking about those who crowded into the mutts of Shankara and all these sacred places around India. And he's talking in these following lines about the Mandukya Upanishad. The self that becomes all these forms of things is the Virat, or universal soul. The self that creates all these forms is Hiranyagarbha, the luminous or creatively perceptive soul. The self that contains all these things involved in it is Prajna, the conscious cause or originally determining soul. Beyond all these is the Absolute, who permits all this unreality, but has no dealings with it. Into that tat. We must withdraw and have no farther dealings with the universe, since knowledge means the final knowledge, and therefore these lesser realizations must fall away from us or be lost in that. But evidently from our point of view, these are practical distinctions made by the mind which have a value for certain purposes, but no ultimate value. Our view of the world insists on unity. The universal self is not different from the perceptive and creative, nor the perceptive from the causal, nor the causal from the absolute, but it is one self-being which has become all becomings. Isha Upanishad, verse 7. And which is not any other than the Lord who manifests himself is all these individual existences, nor the Lord any other than the sole existing Brahman, who verily is all this that we can see, sense, live, or mentalize. That self, Lord Brahman, we would know that we may realize our unity with it and with all that it manifests. And in that unity, we would live. For we demand of knowledge that it shall unite. The knowledge that divides must always be a partial knowing, good for certain practical purposes. The knowledge that unites is the knowledge. And by the by, the Mandukya Upanishad, unlike the commentators, describes all those four phases of self-existence as real and does not assign unreality to any of them, nor does it say that the fourth state, Chaturtham, later called Turiya, is to be preferred exclusively to all the others. All are real. Therefore, our integral yoga will take up these various disciplines and concentrations, but harmonize, and if possible, fuse them by a synthesis which removes their mutual exclusions. Not realizing the Lord and the All, only to reject them for silent self or unknowable absolute, as would an exclusively transcendental, nor living for the Lord alone or in the All alone, as would an exclusively theistic or an exclusively pantheistic yoga, the seeker of integral knowledge will limit himself neither in his thought, nor in his practice, nor in his realization by any religious creed or philosophical dogma. He will seek the truth of existence in its completeness. The ancient disciplines he will not reject, for they rest upon eternal truths, but he will give them an orientation in conformity with his aim. We are not at war with all these varying paths. We do not submit to partiality. We insist on the broadest based, the most concrete experience of unity. Oneness. We must recognize that our primary aim in knowledge must be to realize our own supreme self more than that self in others, or as the Lord of nature, or as the All. For that is the pressing need of the individual, to arrive at the highest truth of his own being, to set right its disorders, confusions, false identifications, to arrive at its right concentration and purity, and to know and mount to its source. Yes, your business is yourself. Perfect yourself first. But we do not, pardon me, but we do this not in order to disappear into its source, but so that our whole existence and all the members of this inner kingdom may find their right basis, may live in our highest self, live for our highest self only, and obey no other law than that which proceeds from our highest self and is given to our purified being without any falsification in the transmitting mentality. And if we do this rightly, we shall discover that in finding this Supreme Self, we have found the one self in all, the one Lord of our nature and of all nature, the all of ourselves, who is the all of the universe. This is again the first verse of the Isha Upanishad. For this that we see in ourselves, we must necessarily see everywhere, since that is the truth of his unity. By discovering and using rightly the truth of our being, the barrier between our individuality and the universe will necessarily be forced open and cast away, and the truth that we realize in our own being cannot fail to realize itself to us in the universality, which will then be ourself. The awakened individual will become the universal self, the universalized individual. Realizing in ourselves the I am he of the Vedanta, we cannot but realize in looking upon all around us the identical knowledge on its other side, thou art that. We have only to see how practically the discipline must be conducted in order that we may arrive successfully at this great unification. So the I am he, Isha Upanishad, verse 16, Soham Asmi, and that thou art that, Chandogya Upanishad, 6:8-7, spoken to Shvetaketu, he whose brightness is white, or who is white clarity, that great finder of Brahman. So his synthesis here is not to take the various philosophical orders and try to bring them into a unified epistemology, but to go back to the ground of experience. His synthesis ties all together in all possible spiritual knowledge into one conscious body, which is the awakened soul. You are that. We'll take up the 7th chapter, the Lord is willing, next time. I thought we could read from Savitri tonight. This is in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 5, The Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness, and it begins on page 81. as when a timeless eye annuls the hours, abolishing the agent and the act. So now his spirit shone out wide, blank, pure. His wakened mind became an empty slate on which the universal and soul could write. All that represses our fallen consciousness was taken from him like a forgotten load. A fire that seemed the body of a god consumed the limiting figures of the past and made large room for a new self to live. Eternity's contact broke the molds of sense. A greater force than the earthly held his limbs. Huge workings bared his undiscovered sheaths. Strange energies wrought and screamed tremendous hands, unwound the triple cord of mind and freed the heavenly wideness of a Godhead's gaze. As through a dress the wearer's shape is seen, there reached through forms to the hidden absolute a cosmic feeling and transcendent sight. Increased and heightened were the instruments. Illusion lost her aggrandizing lens. As from her failing hand the measures fell, atomic looked the things that loomed so large. The little ego's ring could join no more. In the enormous spaces of the self, the body now seemed only a wandering shell, his mind the many-frescoed outer court of an imperishable inhabitant, his spirit breathed the superhuman air. The imprisoned deity rent its magic fence. As with a sound of thunder and of seas, vast barriers crashed around the huge escape. Immutably coeval with the world, circle and end of every hope and toil, inexorably drawn round thought and act, the fixed, immovable peripheries effaced themselves beneath the incarnate's tread. The dire velamen and the bottomless crypt between which life and thought forever move, forbidden still to cross the dim dread bounds, the guardian darknesses mute and formidable, empowered to circumscribe the wingless spirit in the boundaries of mind and ignorance, protecting no more a dual eternity, vanished, rescinding their enormous role. Once figure of creation's vain ellipse, the expanding zero lost its giant curve. The old adamantine vetoes stood no more. Overpowered were earth and nature's obsolete rule. The python coils of the restricting law could not restrain the swift arisen God. Abolished were the scripts of destiny. There was no small, death-hunted creature more, no fragile form of being to preserve from an all-swallowing immensity. The great hammer beats of a pent-up world heart burst open the narrow dams that keep us safe against the forces of the universe. The soul and cosmos faced as equal powers. A boundless being in a measureless time invaded nature with the infinite. He saw, unpathed, unwalled, his Titan scope. Namaste. Jai Ma.